As has been mentioned a couple of times, I do serve as a police chaplain for two departments in Salt Lake City. January 1st will be now 7 years working with them. And I'm always amazed that as I ride with officers weekly, we can be joking in their car and just talking, but as soon as that call comes out, their focus changes very quickly, especially when it's a matter of life and death. We can be talking, and then instantly they change to very focused on what they need to do. A few years ago, I had just gotten into one of our police trucks with a friend. I know him really well, and he said, hey, there's actually a chase going on right now, and I'm going to go to the highway, and if we need to, I'll spike the tires. And so we started going that way, and the car they were chasing turned east, and so away from where we were. But then the words that they dread came out, shots fired. And as our officer, who I know well, was chasing, the suspect was chasing back at our officer. And so that became a matter of life and death very, very quickly. And so as I looked over my friend, his face changed. And he just knew he had to get there immediately. And so we were going incredibly fast. Thankfully, it was later at night. But his focus was so intent on getting to his friend who was being shot at that we were going through red lights without him even noticing. And I would say, red, 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 thinking, I don't want to die, but you need to be able to slow down to get there. But he was so intent of getting there. Because it was a matter of life and death. Now, likewise, as Christians, our goal, once we've been changed by the gospel, is to live with such focus on the mission to which God has given to us, which is a matter of eternal life and death. And so our focus should be completely on the mission to which God has called us to. And in God's kindness, he has given us examples of men, though still sinful and human like us, who dedicated and demonstrated a life that is lived on mission. If you look down in Acts chapter 17, we'll read verse 16 down through 21. It says, now while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him. And some said, what does this babbler wish to say? Others said, he seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities, because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took hold of him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? For you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what else or what these things mean. All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. We'll really focus our attention this morning on just those first two verses. But every time we look at the book of Acts, it's really important to ask what just happened, to fit it into the context. If you go back a couple of chapters in chapter 15 and verse 36, it's the beginning of the second missionary journey. Paul and Barnabas desire to go back and to strengthen the churches that they have been on in the first missionary journey. But as they get ready to go, there's conflict in between the two of them, and that happens. And the conflict is so sharp that Paul takes Silas with him, and Barnabas takes John Mark. Paul then goes on to Derbe and Lystra, where at Lystra he meets Timothy and begins to mentor him and begins the relationship with Timothy. From there, they go on to Troas, where Paul then receives the Macedonian call. But it's also at Troas where the pronouns we see in that chapter begin to change. They're now we and us. It's because Luke now joins them as well. After leaving Troas, they head over to Philippi, where they then lead Lydia and the Philippian jailer to Christ. And after leaving that jail in Philippi, they then go to Thessalonica, where they spend about 3 weeks in the synagogue. And things go well. People are saved. But as happens where Paul typically goes, there are others who don't like what Paul is doing and the power that they think they are losing because of the message of the gospel. And they then cause an uproar. Paul and Timothy and Silas are forced to leave. They head to Berea, where they then present the gospel. More people trust in Christ, but the Thessalonian Jewish people didn't like what he was doing there, and they also then go to Berea, cause an uproar there. And Paul, we don't know why Silas and Timothy didn't leave this time with him, but Paul by himself leaves and goes by boat to Athens. And that is where we find Paul right now, in the city of Athens, simply waiting for Silas and Timothy to come to him. And in these two verses in particular, I believe, demonstrate Paul's lifestyle for living for God's glory and for the furtherance of the gospel. That is living on mission. His lifestyle for God's glory and for the furtherance of the gospel. That's what I mean by living on mission. We live for God's glory, but we also live to further the gospel of God. There's a lot made today of intentional or missional living. It can kind of become cliche and a little overdone sometimes, but it's a good reminder that we as Christians must live our lives in a very particular way. You know, as Christians, we are to live a unique life. Not weird, but unique. It should be different. And we are to live consistently on mission to which God has called us to. You know, those in the military go out on missions, and it may be a day, maybe a week, and even possibly even to a year. But we as Christians, every day should be lived on mission, living for God's glory and living for the furtherance of the gospel. And Paul demonstrates for us in these two verses this missional lifestyle. And in doing so, he demonstrates to us that we should never miss an opportunity to live on mission. Never miss an opportunity to live on mission. We're getting to that time of year, right, where we're doing New Year's resolutions. This would be a great one. Never miss an opportunity to live on mission. So how do we live on mission? I think these two verses show us four keys to live on mission. First of all, be committed to where God currently has you. This may seem overly simple, but what was Paul doing here? Waiting. That's all he's doing. He's waiting for Silas and Timothy to come to him. Paul seems to be a guy who is always on the go, was he not? From synagogue to synagogue, from city to city, from riot to riot, from uproar to uproar. That's Paul's life, always doing something. He kept a busy schedule as he traveled on each of these journeys, but all we find him doing in Acts 17, verse 16, is waiting. Waiting for Silas and Timothy to come to him. Today, if you were to travel from present-day Berea, which is now called Veria, it would take you about 5 hours by car. It's about 314 miles, not very far. Obviously, Paul didn't travel this way, but most people estimate it would take about 12 days' journey for him to come if he did it by foot, but we're told here by Luke that he actually went here by boat, which would take him only 3 days. So not a very long time at all. So for the people to then return back to Berea to get Silas and Timothy and then to have them come wouldn't have been a very long period of time at all. We do find later in Acts 18 that Silas and Timothy actually meet Paul in Corinth. So for some reason, which we're not told why, they never actually came to Athens. They actually meet Paul in Corinth. But Paul had asked them to come to Athens where he was. And so we think, well, maybe Paul was in a really long waiting period. It really wasn't. It was a really simple, maybe week, maybe 2 weeks for Silas and Timothy to join him. And after all that Paul just went through, from having a conflict with a team member to having a switch, now the Macedonian call comes in, to then discipling Timothy, to then going to Thessalonica and having to leave in a hurry, to then leaving Berea in a hurry, to now coming to Athens, we would think, Paul, take a break. You've gone through so much. Take a break. But does Paul do that? He doesn't. He never misses an opportunity that God gives him. He wasn't simply content to sit back and relax while he waited. He easily could have, right? All that he went through just before this, we would think, you have a week, take a break, take a vacation. You need it. But as Paul simply waits here, he sees where God has him. He wasn't content to wait for what's next. Are you in the stage of life right now where you are waiting for what's next? You know, some people can perpetually live in that state. What's next? Always looking for something better to come. Many people are never satisfied with where they are. Instead, they're longing for, with expectation for what's next. It could be that maybe you took a job, but you knew you were immediately going to look for another job that had better hours or better pay or better benefits. Maybe you long to have a child, but that hasn't happened yet. Maybe you wish you were out of college and into the real world. Maybe you have small kids who are going through a really, 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 really bad phase right now, and you wish I wish they would just get out of that phase. We're going through one of those right now with Brooklyn, and it drives us nuts. It's like, please, what's next after this stage? Maybe you're nearing retirement and you just wish you were there now. Or maybe you're in retirement and what's next is not the best thing in the world, but maybe you think, wow, I miss the routine of life. I want to go back to where I was. What's next? So often we wish we were someone else or wish we had different circumstances than where we are right now. But what this shows is a lack of trust in God for your present circumstances. Be committed to where God has you today. Laura and I did go to Northland International University, and our chancellor, Les Olala, had all these pithy statements, and they put them all around campus. And there was one that I always saw that really bothered me for a while, and it said, "Be where you are." I loved Northland, loved being at that school, but I hated the location. Dunbar, Wisconsin is not a great place to be, especially this time of year. I love the school, but every time I thought about that, I grew up in Lima, Peru, which was 8 million people. Cleveland is not a small place, but Dunbar, you reach the end of civilization, and then you go 20 miles further and you get to Dunbar. It is the middle of nowhere, and I hated that about the place. Now, who would put a college up in northern Wisconsin? And I struggled being there because I thought, this is not what I'm comfortable with. I wish I was out in the real world. But every time I saw that statement, "Be where you are," it convicted me. If we believe that God is sovereign, he is in total control of our circumstances, then trust that God has you where you are for a perfect reason. The job that you don't like right now, God has coworkers there for you to interact with right now. That crazy phase your kid is going through, God is teaching you patience and helping you to teach your child. The college class you are dreading taking next semester, God has a purpose for it, unless it's calculus. Waiting is challenging, is it not? It's very difficult. We're by nature very patient people, right? We only have 11 more months to wait until Ohio State beats Michigan again. It will go fast and it will happen again. But we must wait for that to happen, especially after last night. Waiting is a challenge. We aren't by nature patient. But pray to God that he would give you the patience to wait on him and commit to being where you are today. It's exactly what the Apostle Paul did. There's a guy named Sebastian in our church, and a couple of weeks ago I was talking to him. He is about 20 years old, and he's in the National Guard. But he wants to transfer over to the Army, but they're not letting him do that. And it's become a really source of frustration for him. And I was talking to him. I said, "How's it going?" He said, "Well, I'm frustrated, but I've been praying that God would give me patience and that I wouldn't waste this time as I wait for those transfer orders to go through, but that I would actually serve God as I wait." I said, "That's great. Don't waste your time. God has you here with us for a reason right now." So encouraged by him saying that, saying, "I'm praying to God that he would give me patience and to serve while I wait." Serving while he waits is exactly what Paul does. As we'll see in just a second, he went on serving here in the city of Athens as he simply waited. But commit yourself with the Spirit's help to serve where you are today. Be committed to where God has you currently. You may not like your circumstances. Your circumstances may actually be less than ideal. But be committed to where God has you. Don't wish your days away. Don't wish for tomorrow. Trust our sovereign God. Trust that he has you where you are for a purpose. And be committed to where he has you. The next key to living on mission is to be aware of the people around you. says there that while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within in him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So Paul wasn't simply committed to where God had him. Paul was also aware of what was going on around him. No doubt Paul would have had time to go around the city of Athens. It was past its glory, but it was still a famous city at that time. He would have seen the elevated Acropolis, the city's ancient citadel that contained many, many famous buildings, including the Parthenon. He would have gone to the Agora, where people went on a daily basis, and would have seen its beautifully painted areas that were painted by famous painters, and where the intellectuals of Athens would have gone to go and debate. And Paul was a very intellectual man, so he would have enjoyed this. But he wasn't just aware of the beauty of the city around him. He wasn't impressed with the architecture and the arts and the grandeur of Athens. He became aware that the city was full of idols. Now, having been raised as a good Jew, Paul would have known well the Ten Commandments, specifically Commandments number 1 and 2, to have no other gods, and then to have no other graven images or idols. And as he walked around, these two commandments would have been violated all around him. It struck him that everywhere he looked, there were idols. The word that Luke uses here for full of idols is nowhere else used in the New Testament, and it's actually not found at all in Greek literature. Most translate it, it is full of idols, but really it means it is under idols. There is such an oppression because there are idols literally everywhere. It is being smothered by them. Everywhere you look, there are more idols, and everywhere your eye goes, you see something that is new, because it is a new idol. This caught Paul's eye, and it made him aware of the spiritual condition of the people around him. It also would have reminded him of the deep spiritual needs of these people around him. You know, most of the time that we travel to well-known cities, we don't think about the people, do we? You know, Laura and I saved our credit card points for 4 years. We went to Rome in May. I can't remember a single person in Rome. But I can remember the sights and the amazing architecture that is there. But that wasn't Paul. He wasn't focused on the stuff around him. He was focused on the people. Are you aware of the people who God places in your path? Or are you so self-focused on your own life that people come and go around you without you even noticing them? And I get it. We're busy people. We're Americans. This is the way we live our life. We're always on the go, always doing something. Now, Laura and I were just talking about this a few weeks ago. How can we make life slow down? It's impossible. Life is fast. There's always something to do. I believe it's one of Satan's ploys to keep us unaware of the needs of people around us. We're always doing something, but there are people walking around us all the time who have so many needs. Now, it's not an excuse, but it's a reality that we must overcome, our busyness. And as Christians, we can so easily fall into this trap. We can be so self-consumed with our Christian busyness that we never even see the opportunities of the world around us that is hurting. And if we go to our church on Sunday, we may even put our kids in a Christian school. We go to church on Wednesday. We go to Bible studies with men and women. We help a family from our church. We go to a playgroup with Christian moms. And though none of these are wrong in and of themselves, they can keep us so isolated from the world that we never even see that there are so many needs around. And Satan uses these things to keep us trapped in our Christian business, in our Christian little life, that we forget that there are people around us all over who have desperate needs. You know, I guarantee you, if you would go and you would serve in the city of Elyria this year, you would see that there are many, many needs all around us. But do you even give yourself time to go do and serve something like that? Now, our family lives in a state that on the outward appearance seems so perfect. Utah to many is a little utopia. it seems like everyone has it together. There's a good economy. We're number one in the nation right now for economy. There are good paying jobs. We have beautiful scenery, incredible deserts, endless outdoor activities. Yet all around us, every day, people are taking their lives. Constantly. Now, working with police, I see that all the time. A couple of weeks ago, I was driving around in the police car I have, and on the radio, in a three-hour period, three people called in saying, I'm going to take my life, come help me. Just that fast. There's always a view as you come out of our neighborhood where you see the entire valley. And though it is beautiful, there's always a reminder that there are people living all around in the 1.2 million people that are there who are considering ending it right now. They're desperate needs. And yet I can become so self-consumed in my life and in my troubles and in my busyness that I see them and I know what's going on around us, but I don't do anything about it. Because I'm so self-focused on me. My life is busy. My circumstances are hard. And yet as a Christian, I have the hope of the gospel that can help these people. What will we do with these needs? Oh, that we would take the focus off of ourselves and open our eyes to the needs that are around us. The next time you go to work or interact with your neighbors, will you be aware of their needs? Will you be aware of your neighbor who doesn't have the nicest yard and maybe wonder what's going on in their life? Will you be aware of the people in the lower income levels of Elyria that barely have enough food to make it? Will you be aware of those around you who hate Christ and with that hate this church because of everything that it stands for? Will you see their needs? There are needs everywhere around us. There are so many people hurting around us. But I pray that this church would be a church that is constantly aware and meeting those needs. People are hurting, but we have the hope and peace of Jesus that can change that need. Are we looking? Are we aware? The third key to living on mission is to be moved with compassion for those around you. Paul moved from simply observing what he saw to compassion for what he saw. Luke says that his spirit was provoked. Again, it's another interesting word that Luke uses here. It's only used one other time in the New Testament. Actually, Paul uses it in 1 Corinthians 13. It's to stimulate or to irritate or to rouse to anger. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13 that love is not irritable. So it seems that Paul, in some ways, is contradicting his lifestyle here because he's now irritated by what is going on around him. And he's not loving the people, but that's not the way this is happening. The verb that Luke uses here is a gradual coming to this conclusion. As Paul walks around the city of Athens, he gradually sees more and more and more idols. And his heart is provoked within him. It's very similar to when many of the Pharisees and Sadducees, the more and more they heard Christ, the more and more irritated they got with him. It was a gradual process. They didn't want to see who Christ was, and the more they heard from him, the more their hearts were hardened. It's the same type of provoking that the people of Israel did to the Lord. He was all sufficient for them, but they continually worshiped other gods, and they provoked him to anger. But the Lord's anger was holy because he was jealous for his own name. And similarly here for Paul, he is irritated by seeing all these idols because he wants them to worship the one and true God. But the more and more that he sees as he walks through this famous city, he sees idols and he realizes they are not worshiping the true God. They are worshiping all kinds of false gods. And he is jealous for God's name and he becomes irritated by all these idols around him. But Paul's anger is rightfully placed, and then we see that Paul didn't get anger and march off and saying, you guys are so lost, I am done with you. There are idols everywhere to everything but the true God. I am leaving this city. Paul didn't allow that to happen in his life. Rather, he reasoned with the people, which we'll look at in just a little bit. And I believe this demonstrates the compassion in Paul's part. He saw the need of the people around him, and he was moved by it. We must see the need, but we can't stop at that. We must be moved with compassion for those in need around us. This may be a really pointed question, but I think it needs to be asked. When we see the need around us, do we even care? You say, how could you ask that? How could you say that? I think the American church is at a point in time where we see there is a vast difference between what we believe and what the culture believes. It's us versus them. We watched the movie in Sunday school, which showed a very changing theology, very liberal theology. And though it is wrong, and we must fight against that, we can put people in the us versus them mentality. They are the unbelievers. They are the ones who reject God. They make sinful choices. They practice sinful lifestyles. We are the Christians. We follow God. We are right. And so this us versus them mentality creeps in. But we must never forget that we were once them. We all started as them. Paul reminds us in Ephesians 2 that we were by nature children of wrath. And we can so easily become to the point where we think, well, it's them, and we don't want to do anything with them. Though we see their needs, they reject God, and it's their fault. And we don't even try to meet their needs because we're so frustrated with them. We must remind ourselves, if it weren't for grace, we would still be them. Paul constantly reminded himself of that. He wasn't better than anybody else. It was grace that changed him. It was grace who made him who he was. And that's why he consistently gave the gospel to these people who rejected Christ. Do we care? Almost 2 years ago, I got a text saying we had a major accident right near our home, and so I went out there. And as I got there, we had 3 Life Flight helicopters on the highway ready to take off as soon as they got the patients. A man was super high, was driving 110 miles an hour, blew through a stop sign, hit a truck, which then hit a van, killed a little baby in the van, and then hurt the parents and hurt the other passengers in the truck. So we went to the hospital. Had the really, really hard job of telling the parents that, sorry, your daughter didn't make it, as they were in ICU themselves. But then they told us the guy in the first truck who was hit, he's upstairs, so we went upstairs talking with him, and all he would say to us is, I can see the light. We kept thinking, what do you mean by that? I don't walk away from the light. And he was so medicated, we couldn't talk to him at all, but then I got word 2 days later, he's home. And so our secretary at Harriman Police is a Christian. She said, hey, I think you should go because now you can talk as a pastor would talk with him. So I went to his house, and he was standing, barely had a scratch on him. And as we began to talk, I said to him, you realize God saved your life. And as soon as those words left my mouth, he said, no, he didn't. There is no God. It took me by surprise because most Utahns believe in a God. But he said to me, I was raised in Germany. My parents are atheists. I'm an atheist. There is no God. My truck saved my life. And all I'm going to do is go buy a bigger truck in case this happens again. And I said, did you see your truck? You literally flew off the highway. Your truck flew 100 feet in the air and landed off the highway. Your back end was flipped around. And he said, no, God didn't save my life. There is no God. And my first reaction was, well, you are going to get it. You deserve it, right? But then I'm reminded of the gospel, that I'm undeserving, that I'm no better than he is, and that God in his grace can change me, and that the gospel needs to transform this man's life. But how quickly I revert to, you deserve it, when I know what I deserve, and I receive grace and mercy from Christ. Oh, church, may we never forget that we are saved by grace. It is not our own doing. It is the grace of God alone. You know, as I look around social media, though, especially with this upcoming election year, and we're almost there, it paints a picture, though, of us versus them. I saw something this week that was just devastating from a supposed Christian. Now, really? You're going to say that? And let's be clear, there is an agenda out there against Christianity in America. There is an agenda. But let's also be clear, we have an agenda, and it's called the Great Commission. That is our purpose. Living for God's glory and living for the furtherance of the gospel. That's what we are called to do. That is living on mission. Our agenda should never be about maintaining our freedoms as Americans. Our agenda should be driven through the gospel that has changed our lives and can change other people around us. And when we are driven by this agenda, we are jealous for God's name. This doesn't cause us to hate the world around us. Rather, it causes us to have compassion because we realize we were just like them. This gospel caused Paul to look around him and see the city of Athens was full of idols. And it caused him to be jealous for God's name and the proclamation of his name. Can the same be said for us? You know, I'll be honest, when we start to have compassion for the world around us, our life changes. It really will change. You may be put in some very uncomfortable situations when you're dealing with unbelievers. Now, one of my first ride-alongs, the officer was trying to get me to say it's okay for him to become a polygamist. And I thought, wow, I am not in Ohio anymore. And I thought, this is really uncomfortable. This is really awkward. This is really different. But this man needs Christ. Your life may become uncomfortable. We may not have the time that we used to because we are actively engaging our community. You know, our churches will look different as we engage our communities with compassion. Our churches will have people in it that don't think like we do. They don't act like we do. They may not even vote like we do. And they may look outwardly differently than we do, but it is okay. It's okay. Because when we engage people with compassion, our life changes. But it's for God's glory and it is for the furtherance of the gospel. May we never look at the world around us and think they get what they deserve. May we see their sin and offer them the gospel that gives them hope and peace for this life and the life to come. The last key to living on mission is to be stirred to share the gospel. So Paul is there simply waiting. He looks around him. He's provoked, but it provokes him then to share the truth. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Here's where the gospel reaches its climax in the life of believers. We see the need and we have compassion for those in need, but then we give them the remedy for that need. Whereas we often don't have all resources available to us to meet people's physical needs, we have the most precious resource available to meet the needs of people who have spiritual needs, and that is the truth of the gospel. Each of us has that. Paul was so moved by what he saw that he reasoned in the synagogue and in the marketplace. He didn't throw up his hands in despair and say, "They're so lost, I can't do anything about it." He didn't get angry at their sin and walk away. He didn't try social or government reform to force these people into Christianity. Rather, he shared the good news of the gospel that had transformed his life. He talked about the living and resurrected Jesus. It's all he knew how to talk about. He saw this incredible need and didn't get frustrated. He told them about Jesus, this resurrected Jesus. He knew that this was what these idol-worshiping Athenians needed. You know, honestly, Laura and I live in a place where you almost want to throw up your hands in despair and think, will this ever change? It's been like this way for so long. It's always going to be like this. These people are so narcissistic. They get what they deserve. And we throw up our hands in despair. And you want to do that. But then we're reminded of the simple truth of the resurrected Jesus. That he can change people. That it's not about us. It's not about our words or our methods. It's about the gospel. If the gospel can change me, it can change anybody. We must believe that. I love how Paul went about this. He went about his normal routine. He went to the synagogue first. It's what he did in Thessalonica, what he did in Berea. He didn't change here in Athens. He went to the synagogue. So he went about his normal routine, but he also lived a normal life. He went to the marketplace. He didn't despair. He trusted the gospel to do its work, so he continued the routine of going to the Jewish people first. But he also then went to this marketplace, and I love the way that Luke says it here. He reasoned with those who happened to be there. It seems so flippant, but Luke's not being flippant at all. He knew, as Paul told him the stories of what went on in Athens, there were just people there, and I was there. So they heard the gospel. Pretty simple, right? A normal routine. I'm going about my daily life. I'm waiting for Timothy and Silas. I have time. I'm going to where people are. They're there. I'm here. They're hearing the gospel. Very normal life. I've always thought it'd be very interesting to see what God sees when he puts unbelievers in Christian people's way. He's seeing it from above, seeing people interact, and we see them together, and we realize, oh, this person's in my way, but God's realizing, yeah, I have this for a reason. Would we be aware constantly of the people who are there with us and realize there is a purpose for them being there? They just happen to be here. They happen to be there because God has them there. Laura and I like listening to David Platt. He's a pastor in Washington, D.C., and he said, how do you know God is working in someone's life? If you are in their life, he is working in their life. Are we aware of the people around us? Do we see their need? And then do we give them the truth of the gospel that can meet that need? Paul lived an extraordinary life. Paul lived a very fascinating life. But Paul also lived a very simple life, dependent on God. He observed the world around him no matter where he went. He recognized that he was saved by grace. He recognized that he was not better than anybody else, and he took every opportunity to communicate the gospel. But the goal of this message is not to be more like Paul. The real goal is to be so in love with Jesus, to be so dedicated to his mission and his kingdom that we live our lives the way that Paul lived. His God and his kindness gives us examples of people like us who did this, but he gave us the ultimate example of Jesus. He was committed to where he was. Everywhere Jesus went, he knew he was on the mission that the Father had sent him on. He was aware of those around him, always taking the opportunities to see the needs of the people near him. He had compassion for those around him. Matthew 9:36 says that when he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were a sheep without a shepherd. And he was stirred to give his life. And we just celebrated Christmas, the coming of Christ, and in just a few months we'll celebrate the end of that mission at Easter, the giving of his life. Jesus is the ultimate example given to us. And so this isn't about being more like Paul where you think, well, okay, now I need to be motivated to live like Paul lived. No. Love Jesus. Love him like Paul did. And that will change your life. May this not be our goal only for this coming year, but may it be our life until Jesus returns and his kingdom is fully established.
Let's pray together.
Our God, we thank you for people like Paul, who never miss an opportunity to live on mission, to recognize your glory, to live for your glory,